Welcome to the History Slam podcast from ActiveHistory.ca. Here's your host, Sean Graham.
Thank you, Adam. Welcome to the History Slam, everybody. I am Sean Graham. We're coming at you today nearly live from Toronto, Ontario. It's the final day of the Berks Conference, and we found a friend in the massive crowd of people here. Our good friend from the University of Ottawa, Ann Miller, is here. Welcome to the podcast.
Hi, Sean. Thank you so much for having me.
My pleasure. Thanks for doing this. And you presented on Friday morning, very early.
8 a.m.
I was up at 5:30 in order to get into the city from my parents' house to see that presentation. It was well worth my time, so I was pleased to come in and see it. And it was a really interesting panel because it was focused on women in science, and there were some really luminary figures in the room on Friday.
Yes, I was very lucky to co-present with Ruby Heap, who is also from the University of Ottawa, and I got to meet some amazing women, very active and prolific authors and scholars in the field of science and engineering, both in Canada as well as France and the United States. And I learned a lot, and we had some great lively discussions and debates. But Margaret Rossiter was there, who most people know. It was great, and we also, all of us, got to meet Ursula Franklin, and she came to see the last portion of our talk and then had a discussion with Ursula Franklin afterwards.
And she was really interesting. Like, she was so funny because I think Ruby asked her a question, which I thought was a rather sort of a short-ended or short-form answer, and she talked for like 20 minutes.
It was great.
And it was interesting. Like, it wasn't like she was rambling. Like,
no.
She was so good.
She's actually really great. I read, she recently did in March, an interview with in the Atlantic, and the interviewer said, you know, I have some questions for you, kind of as a prelude to the interview. And she said, oh, well, don't worry, I'll take it over from there. And her, if you look online, you see this one sentence question and then 3 to 4 paragraphs of a response from Dr. Franklin. Yeah. And she really knows, or it seems to me, and I don't want to speak of what she believes, but what I'm impressed by is she has such a strong message. And she's clear on what she wants to convey to her audience and the importance of the issues that she's discussing.
Yeah, and sort of in your presentation, and you and Ruby co-presented.
Yes.
And Ruby talked about her career, Ursula Franklin's career, and the thing that sort of stood out for me was not so much the academic experience, which is obviously extensive and impressive, but the life experience of growing up in Germany. She was in a Nazi forced labor camp.
Yes.
Before coming to Canada, and then comes and has this distinguished career. It's unbelievable. Like, you talk, or at least with athletes, people always talk about the second act of their life. Like, they retire when they're 38, 39.
Yes.
And then they have to go on with the second act. With Ursula Franklin, she's had like 8 acts
in
her life. And each one has been very impressive.
Well, that's actually, I would say, what strikes me most about these women. So we've been looking at Ursula Franklin within the context of the activism, the feminist activism specifically, of women scientists and engineers. And you look at these women, and this is not their career. This is in addition to their career.
Right.
They have full-time academic jobs. They are publishing extensively and very prolifically, and they're having a profound impact on their field. So not just, and I say just with quotations, but this activism. And they're so compelling in this additional work they do, and it's a passion of theirs.
Mm-hmm.
And
mm-hmm.
She's a perfect example of these women.
Yeah, and she's... She walked in and she's, I don't know, 5'5"?
Yeah, she's like, very tiny.
She's a small woman, but packs a big punch. And it was really fun to listen to her speak.
And she speaks so deliberately.
Yeah.
In how she conveys her message.
Yeah. There's a purpose to everything she says. There's something people always said about John Wayne. Whenever he took a step, there was a reason that he took that step. And with her, it seems like there's a reason for every word that she speaks.
Yes.
She's not speaking just to be heard. Like, there's a purpose.
Yes.
So.
And I think it's a carefully thought out purpose. So we talked a lot in the presentation, and actually Ruby mostly covered her published speeches. And she has 2 volumes, and one is just coming out this summer. And those speeches were actually recreated because she never wrote her speeches down.
Mm.
She didn't have PowerPoint, even when PowerPoint came into existence. She knew these speeches, and they came from this part of her that was her message.
Right.
It wasn't a subject that she'd researched and thought was interesting and thought was important. This was her real thoughts, something that was at a deeper level for her. And I think how she constructs her feminist activism points to the fact that this is something bigger and larger, and it includes all of these different facets of what made her into who she is. So her pacifism is an integral part of her feminism, and the two cannot be separated.
Mm-hmm. Now, before we get too deep into this, let's get back to sort of what you guys were doing, because this presentation was part of a larger project that you and Ruby are working on as part of the Women in Engineering Research Group? Is that what it's called?
So it started that way. So okay. It started as the University of Ottawa Women in Engineering Research Group.
Mm-hmm. And that included Mike Thompson and
yes,
Carolyn
DeMore. As students, as doctoral candidates as well, and myself got to work with Ruby, and also Crystal Sissons, who was research assistant for Ruby before and continued to work after she finished her degree. And as well, the project itself was a link between Ruby and engineers, so professional engineers, but mostly women in academia.
Yeah.
So it really was an interdisciplinary effort. So we started with that, and I think what Ruby did before I came to the project was she was trying to identify this conversation, which she called the problem of women in engineering. And that was about women's underrepresentation in the field, and actually the persistent underrepresentation of women in the field, and the culture in which they were both learning and working. A lot had to do with the problems of retention. So women that would go into engineering, leave their education, go into the field, have difficulties practicing, and also, of course, the big issue, which was around faculty and really attracting female faculty in faculties of engineering in Canada. I started with that coming in already with the model that we were exploring this problem and how that was articulated both within academia and within professional circles, as well within the larger public. So a lot of attention around why are there so few girls going into engineering? Why are they not interested in math and science? This is obviously a larger dialogue.
Or why didn't girls go into engineering, math, and sciences? Because you're looking at women in the second half of the 20th century.
Yes.
Primarily. So why is there this dearth of women who are entering the field? Is it explained almost primarily by lack of opportunities, or is there sort of a deeper systematic reason to it?
I think it's a very complex issue, and I know everyone says that when asked a question, and I can speak to it in some ways in how these women have tried to solve the problem. And certainly public awareness around the fact that young girls are not being encouraged to go into certain fields or not excelling in certain fields or choosing certain fields is significant. Mm. And a lot of criticism has obviously landed on university programs and why do you only, for example, in the 2000s have around 17% female enrollment within your faculties of engineering. But then I think a lot of women like Monique Fries, who's our first NSERC Nortel, I always have to get the acronyms right as I say them, our NSERC Northern Telecom, Women in Engineering Research Chair, and she was appointed that position in 1989, the first woman. She started looking at education earlier. So let's go to the public schools, let's go to our high schools, and even our elementary schools, and say, how do we get young girls excited about math? How do we get them engaged with science? How do we get the same enthusiasm and response for them that we see and how they engage with literature, and we see how they engage with history and art and all of these subjects that have become associated or been associated with women in our society. And she really ultimately comes to this, or I think her efforts ultimately reveal that this is a multi-pronged approach, that you cannot fix the problem of women's underrepresentation by just looking at one area. We have to look at industry, we have to look at institutions of higher education, we have to look at our public school system, how courses are being taught, how the syllabi are being developed, and how they're representing engineers. How do we see engineers if we always see a male white engineer?
Right.
How can we ask young girls, minorities, different groups to envision themselves in those roles?
Yeah, that was one of the really interesting parts of the presentation. I can't remember who said it, but it was an anecdote that in a first-year engineering class, the professor would say, or I think she would say in all of her engineering classes, describe to me an engineer.
Mm-hmm.
And in 20 years, no one ever described a woman. in writing it down.
It was always masculine and white.
Yeah, which is really quite remarkable. And but one of the things I wonder is that I really do think that a lot of these things can be put back into to elementary schools. And forgive me if I'm wrong on this, but I've always heard that younger kids, that boys tend to learn more from doing, like playing around with stuff and being physical like that. And when I was a kid, that's how science was always taught. Mm-hmm. Like, let's go to the water tank and sort of play around with stuff. And that's how we're going to learn
Let's use the Bunsen burner.
And, right. And so if boys are the ones who tend to learn that way, and if girls learn more either from writing or talking to whatever it is, mm-hmm. but if the skills through which we are teaching science tend to more fall in how boys learn, then you're starting with seven-year-olds with this track. And it's engendered at that point that more boys are going to be interested in science right then, and that's going to sort of go through life. Or am I just completely...
No, and I think what you're speaking to is really interesting just within the context of our discussion, because we're historians, mm-hmm. and we're approaching this topic differently. So there's been a ton of work by sociologists on why young girls choose certain or enjoy certain courses or play certain games, mm-hmm. the language used to speak to little boys compared to the language used to speak to little girls, yeah. the games that girls are given to play with. So yeah. if a little boy is given Legos and Kinects and a little girl is given a doll,
right.
how can we expect that not to develop different skills?
Sure.
And so there's a great game, a great new game for young girls. It's called Goldie Blocks. And it's a pink version of kind of an engineering game. And so we have the visual effect of pink that apparently attracts these young girls. I've heard mothers tell me that it doesn't matter that they give their girls blue toys. They still want the pink toys. So if that is true, mm-hmm. then we will try to attract them with the glitzy pink. But they're using and developing skills that could be used within engineering and
right.
about how things work and how to make a belt move and things like this. But I think the interesting perspective historians can bring to this is in looking at the women who are in engineering,
right.
who are in science, who are in math, who have gone into computer engineering, for instance, which is heavily dominated by men,
mm-hmm.
and say, what did they enjoy when they were young? What did their father do? What did their mother do? Was their mother a feminist? Did their mother push higher education? And there are a lot of questions. So when we look at someone like Ursula Franklin, and she tells us, I went into this because history did not look so great at the time that the Nazi Party came to power. And I thought I wanted something more definite that could not be undermined by a political agenda.
Mm-hmm.
And to get that story, to have those stories, the value of those stories in trying to understand what motivates a young woman to enter a career that's dominated by men, that's perceived as masculine, that our society tells them is really not a good fit for women,
mm-hmm.
and actually may not be a kind fit for women. It may not help them. It may make their life more difficult. It may have at times a fear element. We have to look at those women's lives to see how did you enter this field? What motivated your decision?
Mm-hmm. And clearly, if there are these systems in place through which women cannot, or there's barriers to their entry into these fields, then obviously the ones who get in are going to be particularly strong-willed and independent and really just sort of able to overcome these barriers, whereas there are people, and it's I think there are men like this too, who they come to a barrier and they say, that's it.
Yeah.
I'm going to stop. And the women who are getting through, someone like Ursula Franklin, is saying, nope, mm-hmm. I'm going right through this,
mm-hmm.
and I don't care. And that takes a certain personality type.
Yes.
Right? And so obviously part of getting more women involved then would be breaking down those barriers so that women who maybe don't have that sort of same attitude can still pursue the field.
Well,
right?
It's interesting what you're saying, because what you're pointed to, in effect, is a personality that says, this is not fair.
Yeah.
This is not right.
Yeah. And even other women who would say, this isn't fair, they would get to that block and maybe say, well, I don't know what to do. Or maybe there's economics, factors in play that sort of force them then to reconsider.
Yes.
And then because there is a risk in trying to break through barriers.
Definitely.
And, some people would maybe just be risk averse. So,
yes.
So, right? And so there is a personality that you see with sort of trailblazers.
Yes, yes. Right? And that actually, that would be an interesting area to study, is what characteristics do all of these women have in common? Mm-hmm. I know Ruby's been interested in looking at why there seems to be a larger percentage of Eastern European women in engineering, and what is in their culture or in their educational background before coming to Canada that has encouraged this. What in their society makes this permissible, as opposed to our society, where we still have 17%.
Yeah.
You know, we went up to 20%, but we've come back down and hovered around 17%. Mm-hmm. So it's an interesting question. But I think that that actually speaks as well to another aspect. And when you look at Ursula Franklin, you see this, is that a lot of these feminist activists in science and engineering, their activism has a strong social justice component. Mm-hmm. And that, and they're not, it's not just about women. It's not just about, and I say just again in quotations, it is about women entering these fields, but it is also about bettering society. Mm. This is a larger goal. Ursula Franklin believes that society, that engineering, that technology will be better with women in those fields.
Mm-hmm. And it's something that I talked about with Cynthia Enloe a couple of days ago, and we talked about it on the podcast, is that it's not just necessarily having women, but having a feminist perspective,
yes,
which isn't necessarily gender specific.
Mm-hmm.
And because one of the things that was said in the session was that having women in science and technology makes science and technology more responsive.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the things I wondered when I heard that is, how does it become more responsive through the presence of women? Is it because they're asking different questions? As Cynthia was saying, that a feminist perspective brings a different question. And is the inclusion of different questions make science and technology therefore more responsive?
I'm going to give you some quotes by Ursula Franklin to answer this.
Okay.
Because I think that's what we really stressed as well in the presentation, is her words and her perspectives. She repeated routinely to Dr. Heap in her interviews that feminism is not an employment agency.
Mm.
Feminism is larger than an employment agency. It's an attempt to build a different moral order and a movement to change relations between people.
Mm.
And I thought that was very powerful. And she says that feminist scholars, their impact on science and engineering is that they ask, yes, they ask different questions. They say, is there something wrong with science in the professions? Not just in their practice, and I think this is important, not just in their practice, but in their structure. How is this organized?
Hmm.
How can we change the structure of these fields?
But at a certain level, right, chemistry is chemistry, right?
Yes.
Or engineering is engineering. Like, you know what? If you build a bridge and it falls down, that's not good engineering, right? The bridge has to stay up.
She would say the bridge is better for the different experiences, I think, that that inform how do we build the bridge and the questions they ask.
Mm.
So I know in some of her writings, and I don't have a quote handy, but she would talk about that women will ask questions about the social impact, the impact on human beings. So she talks about the humanization of science.
Right. Because I think a lot of people don't view science as a human thing, right? It's just these facts.
I think that may be a perspective of maybe a non-scientist, but if you look at the debates around the effect of technology on human beings and the effect of technology on labor patterns, I would say that it's intrinsically tied to the human experience, especially if you take Dr. Franklin's definition, which is so broad, which is just technology is the way we do things, which I just thought was so blunt and just very broad, but a great way to conceptualize it. And I think if we look at that as how does engineering interact with human development, how do we look at that work within the context of bettering society? And if that's a goal of the profession, which it is,
sure,
generally it's a stated goal of many engineering faculties, is this is about improving, then we need to look at how human beings are influencing that field.
Right. I know a couple guys who are engineers, or at least have gone through for school as engineers, and, you know, you notice the ring that they wear, the pinky finger ring. I don't think I've ever seen a woman or met a woman who has an engineering ring. Like, I don't think I know any women engineers.
Okay. I have a cousin that's a female.
Okay,
engineer.
There you go. But yes. Like, but so to me, like, it struck me when I was in that room is like, it's true in that, like, in my life, not only if someone said picture an engineer, if I was in that class,
yes,
you know what, I probably would describe a man too. But I've also never met a female engineer, which probably speaks to the way in which it's been engendered.
Yes, I think that your question about the professor asking the class, yeah, you know, how do you picture an engineer? It still stands as true today as it stood in 1960 and 1970. If you go through Engineering Dimensions, which is the publication of the Ontario Engineering Society, consistently these articles refer to the engineer as masculine, and that doesn't change. You don't start seeing a female engineer until you really are getting articles on women in engineering, which really is, you know, 1970s and booming in the 1980s. So I think that what you're speaking to would be the need for more work, more awareness, that we've come obviously a long way from 2.7% sure, women in engineering in 1974 sure, to around 17%, but that there's still work to be done in how we envision certain careers as being genders. We construct them as being gendered. And I know lots of historians of the professions point to medicine and law as being so much further along. And I know historians of those fields will argue that they also are problematic.
Yeah.
But it is important in how we see, you know, do we see a female physician now? Do we see a female lawyer now? Maybe more than we see a female engineer.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe there's a diversity of people that we can envision in those careers and not in engineering.
Yeah. Well, I guess it wouldn't be as unexpected, right?
Yes.
I've met female lawyers. I've met female doctors. I've never met a female engineer. So,
yeah.
Or even, I guess I know a couple of women who do science, who work in labs and stuff. But it is interesting how you conceive of things and how the conceptions can change.
Well, and why is that conception so persistent?
Right.
Why is there a block in trying to envision that? Is that, you know, about media representation? Do we not have any, you know, popular culture female engineering figures? And what are they, and where there are female engineers, how are they interacting with the public? Are they in industry and somewhat segregated from the public, as opposed to someone going to a female doctor and seeing a female doctor in practice, in work? Mm-hmm. How much of us have a relationship with an engineer in their work?
Right. Yeah. They're not as there's not nearly as much social interaction as with a doctor.
Yes.
Because I don't recall ever making an appointment to go see an engineer.
Yes.
I haven't had that need
exactly
in my life. And even too, like, you think of the people at Waterloo, the engineer students, like during Frosh Week.
Mm-hmm.
To me, it's always a group of guys running around and dumping paint on each other or whatever it is. Right. It just doesn't seem as diverse.
Which, of course, has gotten a lot of attention and garnered a lot of publicity. And I think that's interesting as well, because when we look at the impact of the dialogue around the problem of engineering, a lot of engineering student cultures have come under attack, and they've been very defensive. And even their female students are not willing to say, there is a problem.
Right.
This culture needs to be changed. I don't feel comfortable within this culture or represented in this culture, or I wish there were more female faculty members. It's quite interesting how women operate within this culture at the undergraduate level, and what that says, I think, about the field and where change can come from.
Mm-hmm.
And so what is our job as a historian in looking at this field and trying to explain it and maybe trying to even change it and trying to draw awareness to certain mm-hmm. issues?
The result of this work that you're doing, said we're at 17.5% or whatever it is of mm-hmm. women in engineering. You know, what's the hope for your work, this group? I mean, what's the end result of this going to be?
So this is a larger project to draw attention to the feminist activism of women in science and engineering. So when we look at the historiography on the women's movement, women scientists and engineers do not play a large role in this scholarship, and actually they're largely absent until recently.
Mm-hmm.
And it's only recently that we've looked at these women as being feminists or looked for their feminism, looked for examples of their feminist activism. How did they participate in the women's movement? What contributions did they make to the women's movement? How did they shape the women's movement? So when we look at the United States and the scholarship there, for instance, which of course we're always kind of comparing
sure.
scholarship on the women's movement in the U.S. to Canada and trying to see the similarities and the differences. When we look to that scholarship, we see feminist technology studies. We don't have similar fields here in Canada. And they're asking important questions about the relationship of feminism to science.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, technology, I have to distinguish between technology and science and engineering. You know, when we're looking at women who are entering careers in science and engineering, we are looking at women entering professions. So
mm-hmm.
There are multiple different areas that we're talking about. But really, we want to know the relationship of these women because they were doing extraordinary and amazing things. They were not only entering amazing careers at a time when no other women were, but women like Ursula Franklin were promoting women in these fields.
Right.
They were trying to change not only their field, but their society.
Which is a difficult thing to do. But it's also part of what this conference is about. And this is my first time at the Berks. The first time I'd ever heard of the Berks was 2 years ago at the CHA. When Mary Vipon brought it up, and she said that it's going to be in Toronto in 2 years.
Which is a big deal. Welcome to Canada.
Yes, first time it's been here. It's a triannual conference, so I'm assuming it's your first time.
It is my first time.
Just overall impressions of what it's been like and what your experience has been here since this kicked off on Thursday.
Well, I think there's been a lot of talk about how large the program is. And I'd say that...
clean 200 pages.
how large the program is, how many sessions there are, how many workshops, all of the different opportunities to engage with not only the conference participants and organizers, but also Toronto and the city itself. And I have to say that I've been struck most by how large this community of women is. And that is very empowering for a young scholar, and a male or female, that this is a field that is so large, so diverse, and so inclusive. It's really been, I think that's really one of the themes of this conference, is inclusivity and trying to look at, you know, as the conference says, histories on the edge, these
yeah.
histories that maybe don't always get attention.
Yeah. I know for me it's interesting, though, as one of the few men here, there are other men here, but it's not...
You're the minority.
Yes.
We'll admit that.
I think significantly as well. It's interesting, like at the event on Friday, or even sort of just walking around in between sessions, is that and maybe it's just my perception, is that I feel people like, why are you here? Like that, but yet everyone individually has been very welcome. Like I
yes.
feel intimidated walking around. And yet, when I meet people, everyone's very nice and very welcoming. And I to me, it's interesting because then I compare it to then these, say, women engineers.
Yes.
Is that what they experience?
They experienced worse because they actually got the
yeah.
comments.
Sure, sure. So, so to me, it's really interesting in that respect. But the one thing that I wonder is, you know, in terms of being the number of panels, I haven't been to a panel yet that has been poorly attended.
Yes, I know.
You know, there's 25 panels going on at a time, and yet each one that I've walked into... There's a lot of people in the room.
Yes. 20 plus 30. Yeah. Exactly.
A bunch of like standing room only panels and people out the doors and stuff. But I wonder if, and again, this is my male perspective and my experience with women's centers. And I realize that there's a difference between women's history and women's centers in sort of their overall purpose and all this. But is this conference simply a preaching to the choir type of a situation? Wherein, if we're trying to address these issues of gender imbalance, we need more people who don't necessarily adhere to these things, who look at women's history or gender history as sort of fluff and marginal and not that important. And those are the people who really need to be here to see this work and really understand its implications. I study broadcasting, and I got an article idea out of this conference, which is, to me, I did not expect to have anything relevant to my work, because there was nobody, I don't think. I know Barbara Freeman's here. I don't know if she gave a presentation. But I don't think anyone did anything on broadcasting in the 30s, specifically. So as it relates to me, nobody did content that's similar to what I study. And yet, through these ideas, I got an idea for an article. And I would not have considered myself a gender historian in any capacity. Or even having notions of feminist approach or masculine, anything. Those concepts are things that I'd never considered. So I come to this thing and I sort of, I don't want to say see the light, because I never sort of dismissed gender history, but I just didn't think it was necessarily relevant to what I did. And yet, for those people who are dismissive of it, those are the ones who have to be here, right? To really make a full difference. Or am I just being high in the sky?
I think you're referencing a number of issues too. I think to address the first is that, you know, you're uncomfortable here. You're uncomfortable here because you are not the majority. And as a white male, you are more comfortable. You're more generally the majority.
Yeah.
And I think people talk about having that experience, you know, outside of a women's history conference and other situations, mm-hmm. right? So I actually think you being aware of the fact that you're a minority and feeling a bit uncomfortable is a good growing experience.
Yeah.
It's good to see how do other people feel when they are not the group that is largely represented in a space or largely represented in a topic or a discussion.
Yeah.
And that's what a lot of women said when they said, where are the women in history? Where are they? I'm so tired of hearing about all of these presidents and all of these great male leaders. Where are the women that I can share my experience with or feel that there's a shared experience or a shared understanding or at least to be represented? So I think that be uncomfortable.
Yeah.
Think about the fact that you thought that you are uncomfortable and you've reflected on why you are not, and then reflected on the fact that everyone is very welcoming and everyone is just talking with you and interested in you and interested in what you do, even though it is not a women's history topic specifically, although I would argue it applies to women's history as equally as it does to, you know, male history.
Well, the CBC didn't really let women in.
Yes, but that in itself...
That's relevant.
We talk about
that's
the relevant. Absence of women all the time. Yeah. Where are they not? Right. Yeah. It is relevant. It's amazing. Yeah. And I think what you're speaking about as well is the including of women's history within these larger fields. So I classify myself as a Canadian social military historian. You know, my dissertation is on Canadian universities during the Second World War. It is not at all on the topic that I presented at this conference. And what I struggle with is not having a chapter in a work on women. Having women included in every chapter of that work. Of course, certain policies and legislation did not apply to women at all. But the fact that they did not apply to women says something about those policies and that legislation. And instead of just saying, erasing the male student in my work, I put the male student, the female student, because we have to show where we are talking specifically about men, where we are talking specifically about women. Mm-hmm. Because when we look at history, most of these policies are very gendered. The experiences of these students are very gendered. And it's one of the things that this conference does is it says, look, we have to think differently about human experience. And I'll make one more point because I know I'm going on
No, this is really good.
And that would be that when you come to something like a women's history conference, I think the reason you were inspired, and I'll use a two-part answer here. So the reason you were inspired is on the one point, these are some of the leading scholars in this field.
Sure.
These women are, I've just been struck by how phenomenal they are, how their breadth of knowledge, the way they engage with their subjects, the questions they ask. And that last point is my second point. They ask questions that make you think. They ask questions that make you think about your field, about how you approach your topic. They challenge you to ask new questions. And those questions, in some ways, you know, that's how we do history.
Mm-hmm.
We ask questions, we start with questions. And so in engaging with those questions in a different area of study, in a field that's not yours, that's the value of other subfields of history to each other. We can learn from every conference, whether it's a military history conference, a women's history conference. And I would challenge historians who focus on their field of study, who do not look past their subfield, who are very much embedded in only the scholarship from their fellow scholars, to look at the scholarship of these women, because they're talking about war. They're talking about education. They're talking about everything. They're talking about women in every single context you can imagine, even in contexts where, as you said, they don't exist.
Right.
They're not referenced.
Yeah.
There's very little records.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the value of a conference like this.
I find it somewhat interesting is the ultimate success of this conference, sort of overall, would it not be eventually not having to have a conference like this? That finding a place for women specifically isn't necessary because we've reached a point where it's included. So, like, in the thing I saw yesterday, or the panel I went to yesterday with Vereen Shepherd, and there was three professors from the University of the West Indies, and they were talking about textbooks on Caribbean history and how women aren't referenced in these textbooks. And they have recommendations and say, this is how you have to do it. And the, one of the things they said is that you don't want to have a chapter on women's history. And like you said, you want to have it throughout.
Mm-hmm. Integrated.
Right. And so if everything becomes integrated and women have their place in the surveys and the overall studies, then specific places for women like this, do they not become unnecessary and would show the ultimate success of this field?
That's difficult.
I realize it's like 200 years away.
No, I know. I think it's difficult to answer. So the way that I can have an answer for that is to look at my experience, and that would be in studying institutions of higher education in the World War. I attend conferences on the history of higher education, mm-hmm. and I attend conferences on the on military history.
Right.
Can you envision a place where we just have a Canadian history conference and we don't? And we integrate military history subjects into that conference.
Right.
We don't, because there's something about our field and academic study and the academic process that lends itself sometimes towards getting very specific.
Sure.
And our methodology sometimes, you know, we have issues with that sometimes about the specificity of our topics. But the very fact of how specific our work is at times and our research is at times means that we have to be able to function within a community that's smaller and then also function within a community that's larger and convey the broad themes or talk about the specific details and how they manifest themselves in our work. Mm-hmm. So when you're looking at something as complicated as, you know, the relationship of the academy to women, to education in engineering, mm-hmm. you have a lot of areas there that you're looking at. And of course you could talk to scholars in higher education and learn from them. You could talk to scholars of engineering. You can talk to engineers and learn from them about the experience. So I think there's something about these, about academic conferences where we need the specific and we need the broad. Mm. We need the Canadian Historical Association. Yeah. We need the large conferences. We need the women's history conferences. And we need people to approach them with the attitude of, I can learn from all of these fields. I can get something from this that's relevant to what I do. And I can give something. I can contribute something. And yes, do I think that there's a derision for women's history still? Do I think that that I've heard increasingly comments about how it's not relevant any longer? But I would say that this conference, the reception that this conference has had, mm-hmm. the number of applicants to present, the number of women that attended, which is the largest conference I've ever attended, would say that it's not irrelevant. Right. It is relevant, mm-hmm. and it is important, and it is contributing.
Yeah, no, for sure. And it's interesting. I took a women's history course in undergrad in my second year, 50 people in the class. There's two guys.
Yes.
Now, granted, Nipissing University, the proportion was like 60-40 mm-hmm. women to men anyway. So most classes, it was mostly women. But this one was, even in that context, way to the extreme. And the guys who I knew, a lot of whom were taking military history, were like, why are you taking that? And I mean, part of the reason was it really fit in my schedule nicely.
It wasn't an 8 a.m.?
It was a nice chunk of time that really just worked well with my schedule. But it was a really interesting course as well. And you're right. It forces you to look at things differently, particularly if you're not in that vein. I don't know. I question. I've never been to a military history conference. I question if I would have the same experience at a military history conference. I really do. But again, that's because I'm not involved in it. So I would have asked, before I got here on Thursday, I would have said the same thing. Like, is this actually going to be useful for me in my work? Like, I came here to do these sorts of things, to do these podcasts. And that's why the organizers sort of invited me to come. And so I figured I'm going to come do some podcasts and be done with it. And I didn't expect to actually have some sort of like a genuine intellectual experience that relates back to my own stuff.
I think it's because it's about the range of topics. It's the range of topics that, as you said, like can apply to.
Yeah. It was economic. It was in an economics panel.
Mm. That's great.
I was like, what? it was really quite remarkable. From here, I'm going to St. Catharines. You are not. You're taking some time to breathe and sleep. and finish up your last chapter. You're almost done, so which is very exciting.
But good luck in St. Catharines.
Thank you.
It should be really fun.
Thank you. Yeah, I'm looking forward to it. I'm kind of exhausted, but you know, I got 3 days left of conferencing, so I think we'll make it through. So, but just from you, is there anything on the horizon with respect to the engineering project or anything coming out that you want to direct people to?
There's a big conference coming up in September, early September, and Ruby Heap is organizing that. It's a workshop. And actually, it's going to address the archives of women in science and engineering and how do we preserve these archives and these valuable materials so that they can be used for future historians and that their real substantial contribution can be known and become a bigger part of the history of the women's movement.
And that's in Ottawa?
That's in Ottawa.
So it's in early September. I think you said the 11th.
September 11th.
So people can look that up if they're interested in that.
And, yes.
That is Ann Miller from the University of Ottawa. Thank you so much, Ann.
Thank you, Sean.
If anybody has any questions, comments for the podcast, it's historyslam@gmail.com. Twitter is @DrShawneeFever. And if you're out and you see Enrico Palazzo, please say hi for me.
Thanks for listening to the History Slam podcast. Be sure to check out Active History for more features, articles, and be sure to subscribe on iTunes.